The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to the fifth episode of Unsound Methods with me, Jamie Batchin.
And me, Lachlan Bloom. For those of you listening to the podcast for the first time, this is part of a series where we talk to fellow writers and authors of literary fiction and discuss the motivations, techniques and craft of writing.
In this episode, we caught up with the German writer Esther Kinski. We met her on a rainy winter's evening in Farringdon the day before the launch party for the translation of her novel River, which has recently been released by Fitzcarraldo Editions.
Esther is a widely published author and poet, and also a literary translator, having translated to German from Polish, English and Russian.
Esther was a very interesting writer to speak to. She's got quite a different take on a lot of things, I think you'll hear in the interview coming up. We spoke to her about how location can influence the form of what you're writing, and the journey that her work takes from notes into the different forms that she writes in, whether that's prose, poetry or radio plays. As someone who's multilingual, we also learned about the curious linguistic worlds that are opened up by having those skills. And Esther also talked about the importance of setting your work free and letting the translator make a claim to the text.
And now we give you Esther Kinski. Esther Kinski, thanks for joining us. If we could maybe start at the end, so to speak, and ask you, when you finished River, how you knew you'd finished the book? What was it that signaled the end of this project? And is that different from what signals the end of every other project? Or is there a way you kind of get to a realization that the work is finished?
For me, I have to say, I just know when something's finished. Of course, when you're near the end of a project, you probably have an idea of how you would like it to, or what the end should be. And it's very difficult to explain the process of writing a book which is not really based on any kind of action or narrative stringency. It's, the book has a particular structure. I'm not sure if you noticed this, that there are these individual sections of the walk along the River Lee, and each of these sections is part of a bigger chapter with four parts. And each of these parts has a certain... is a strand, really. And so there are these four strands which eventually come together. They all come together in the end. I mean, not everybody may notice this, but I, as a writer, did make them come together in the end in the way I wanted to.
And was that planned from the start? Or how much preparation did you have before you put pen to paper for the first time?
Well, let's put it like this. I think... structural questions like this, they emerge for me in the course of writing. I have an idea of what I want to do, let's say write about this this period of time of walking along the river. And when I sit and then I, let's say, I suppose I work by preparing a lot mentally. I think a lot about a project. I always have a lot of notes because I take notes wherever I go, and they eventually they will eventually flow into a project. All these notes, more or less, yeah.
And do those notes, are they specific to projects? So when you finish a project, do you then start taking notes for the next one, or is it just an ongoing process?
I wrote this book years after I had taken the notes, because just after, I mean, I took the notes in the early 2000s, and then I left London, and it took me years to really be able to somehow mentally come back to this, these years towards the end of my time in London. And then I can rely on notes, but I also, I suppose, I do have quite a good memory, and I photograph. But the photography is on a, and I mean these Polaroid photographs which are in the book, they are not necessarily what I use as photographic material to resort to when I'm writing. I do analog photography with a medium format camera, which and that would be more my material to go back to. Although I have to say, for me, photography and writing are two completely different levels, just because the framing, the act of framing in photography, creates a memory which is already so detached from the memory in my head, or the memory that would be triggered by notes. It is a complicated dialogue between these two.
They're quite closely related, though, in another sense.
Yes, they are closely related, but I mean, my notes evoke for me completely different memories or lead me down completely different paths than the photographs if I look at them. Yeah, they may then complement each other in a particular way as material for a particular work.
And so when you're taking the notes, you don't know that it will necessarily lead to a novel.
No. I take notes all the time.
So you're taking the notes in the early 2000s, and it was years later that the impetus to write a novel came about. What was that process? What made you kind of coalesce those notes and say, right, this is going to be a novel now?
Well, I have to say this particular novel project went through certain stages, because quite shortly after leaving London, I wrote a long poem, which has actually almost as many parts as this book has chapters. And this prose poem existed, and it is almost like a very sort of condensed, raw version of the book. And then I sort of mulled over this, I recorded it, I combined it with Polaroid photographs of the time. And then at some point around 2012, I suddenly realized how this could then expand into a prose book.
And did you have any insight into what that realization was in 2012? What shifted in your perception to think, now I see this in the form of a novel?
Yes, I think I know what it was, because the 2 years before, I had been invited to write a text, an essay, about another photographer's work, about two rivers that I know quite well, which is the River Rhine, where I grew up, and the River Odra, which separates for a long stretch Poland and Germany. And I wasn't quite so familiar with the Odra, but it's a kind of landscape that always interested me, because it also ends in this beautiful, huge estuary. So I traveled along the Odra. I looked at the photographs of this particular photographer's work, and somehow it triggered a lot of my memories of growing up by a river. And I think it was this sort of engagement with the concept of river, you know, and how do you deal with river as a subject, you know, even if it is visually, it's completely different, of course, from writing about it. But I think at that point, I made an important discovery, important for the project of this prose book, which is that a river forms a border, but it is a visual border which always separates you from the other side, and it sort of gives you a sense of sort of looking at the river becomes a kind of a mobile stage, yeah, and I think this sort of sudden thought or image that was what really triggered my work on this prose book.
And is that a normal? Does it normally come from a sort of conceptual realization at work? Is that the primary impetus normally?
No, not always. I think it just works in very different ways. Sometimes I just find an object from which something will emerge, because I then become interested, let's say, in a particular segment of natural history or local history or so. Yeah, but I mean, all my writing is about place in a way. Yeah, so from that point of view, there are parallels. And
does it always start from, have you ever had an idea for a piece but not been to the place, and you've had to then
never do this. I'm really not interested in writing narrative fiction, just, you know, as fiction.
It has to be something that's come from your own memory of
something that comes from my own engagement with the place, or from a visual engagement with the place, I would say.
So the geography is always sort of very important.
Place is important. Place, and of course, I mean, I travel a lot, but I do like to visit places repeatedly and before I write about them, and have rather intimate knowledge of them. And so that's what I call sort of engaging with place, I would say.
Because another of your works... not familiar with it particularly, but you wrote about the Banat.
Yes.
Is that, I mean, that's somewhere that always strikes me as geographically a very interesting place.
It is.
Because of the sort of political geography of it, mm-hmm, as much as anything else. So is that somewhere that did you move there first and then decide to write about it, or is it somewhere you were led to because you were interested in what was going on there and the different communities?
No. I went, it was really such a sort of string of coincidences. I went there just to photograph and look at this sort of, it's this huge sort of Pannonian basin really in the southeast. And and then I just liked it, and through, it was some really string of freak coincidences, I sort of stayed practically. I bought a house, and from this village where I then lived for years, I sort of started exploring the area, and I then realized how incredibly interesting it is. And I would say not just, yes, of course, politically interesting, but it is mostly also linguistically, culturally interesting, because the margins of Hungary are so multi-ethnic. I mean, the Banat is a place where up to 13 ethnicities really existed side by side in the bigger towns.
Mm-hmm. And does that then impact the geography that you're sort of working with and thinking about? Does that impact the form of what you write?
I suppose it does, but not as a conscious decision. I think the form evolves from text, so to speak.
Is that a constant evolution? Do you see any distinction between the notes you take and a finished piece, or is it just a case of writing and continually evolving or refining a piece of writing from the note stage to the finished piece?
No, I would say, I mean, rereading my notes, looking at photographs, remembering, then puts me on a certain track.
You would never use the original notes.
No, I never do. I think it's different for every writer. For me, it's really concentrating on how I want to start and what tone I would be happy with. And I usually, I mean, it is. For myself, I have to say this: it's an incredibly sort of exhausting act of concentration, yeah. And then it's almost as if it was sort of triggered and had its own momentum. And I very rarely rewrite something or even rephrase.
Mm. But you would make a distinction between the notes and the
writing. absolutely. And
what is the difference? Is there? I mean, if somebody were to read your notes, is it obviously a different?
Well,
style
the notes
of writing,
can be very The notes can be very fragmented. Sometimes they're more detailed and worked out, but very often it's really just about jotting down things. And
what point do you decide that the notes have been compiled enough to turn them into more forms or prose?
There's no decision. I mean, as I said, I take notes all the time, and I have these dozens of notebooks which are filled with notes, and of course they're all chronologically catalogued in a way, and so I can resort to a particular time, I can look at the notes which I took about a particular place, and then something may evolve from that.
Having read River and being familiar with the areas that you walk, I can recognise certain elements, but at the same time there's a really interesting tension with a sort of very fantastical element that is very much not there in depending how you take the photo, in a sort of realist representation of East London. You know, there's characters that kind of evoke historical periods, a circus rider, you know, circuses still exist, but it sort of evokes something that's not present-day London. And I wondered how that sort of blend of the fantastical and the sort of more real...
Yes, but... I mean, there are this circus rider. He's from a strand which is actually the eye narrator's memory of when she first came to London, and this was for me also a way of illustrating. I mean, these fantastical elements of illustrating maybe the alienness she felt or the strangeness of it, yeah, and because then the strand of the walks along the River Lee, or the fourth strand in each chapter, which is set in this immediate little area there in neighborhood, is very realistic, really. There's nothing fantastical about it, but it all comes together towards the end, and sort of the fantastical somehow evaporates in a way.
Mm. Well, the impression, in some ways, is kind of the opposite, in that the fantastical seemed to build and build. At first, it seems a very matter-of-fact description of walks around London and memories of different places. But these sort of slightly alien fantastical elements build in such a way to give the overall, when you finish reading a book, it gives it a very different feel than a lot of, you read a lot of sort of fiction or non-fiction that has psychogeography and doesn't attempt to go in the places that you go with some of these characters.
I agree, but I'm not interested in psychogeography. I mean, I think it's an interesting. I'm not meaning to say it's not interesting, but I'm not interested in writing anything in that direction.
No, and I think that really comes across in the book. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm interested in what stage these more fantastical elements came into your writing. Were you taking them at the note stage, or is this something that once you'd conceived the entire novel?
No, they were partly out of the note stage. I mean, these were sort of notes about which dated much further back still, about which were kind of about projects or drafts of texts about how a person who comes to a new country or a city can how the newness of the gaze can sort of influence the perception, you know, how the alienness of what, or the seeming alienness of what you see just then colors everything in this sort of slightly surreal way.
Yeah, I think there's my impression of the characters as well. You don't, I mean, obviously there's interactions between them, but there's a kind of puzzlement about how they all connect to each other.
Are certain strands. I mean, there is a degree of sort of composition in it all. Mm. Yeah.
So I want to, I mean, as you two, I think, possibly talked about before we started recording, being very familiar with the area, I want to be able to sort of read it without the eyes that have walked along those paths to see it, because it's, I don't know, as someone who is familiar with it, it really evokes it very strongly. Although the one thing that slightly annoyed me is there's places that you described that I think, oh, I didn't realise that was around here. And then I'll Google it and realise that it was knocked down to make way for the Olympics and things like
oh,
that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, this is, that is terrible. I mean, I've had this with a few places that I have written about which just simply do no longer exist, you know, and it's almost as if it was a kind of premonition.
because I think it was really interesting reading it. I've just finished reading it, and I didn't know when you'd written it until earlier on. You were saying it was the early 2000s, and obviously it started.
No, that's when I took the notes. I wrote the book when everything was already destroyed, really.
But you were basing it on the notes rather than...
I mean, I revisited a few, very, very few places, but it was quite obvious. I mean, I started writing the book, really, in 2012. And that was already too late to revisit a lot
of things. But I think it gives it an added poignancy because the route follows through Stratford, where the Olympics now have completely changed the whole area.
Yeah, I must admit, when this decision came through and for the Olympics in 2005, and when it all developed so rapidly, and I was so grateful that I had had this time along the river, and I had really also just had the leisure to spend so much time exploring it really in detail and taking photographs, taking notes.
The party of unsound method. The pilgrims looked upon me with disfavor.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of Unsound Methods. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter at Unsound Methods or via our website at unsoundmethods.co.uk.
Were the photographs that you used literally the photographs of the things that's adjacent in the text, or did you sometimes find a photograph that you thought, it's not quite where I'm describing, but it seems an appropriate picture to...
They are more or less suited to the actual sort of bigger chapter then.
Because that's what I always think, reading Sebald. I'm not quite sure where I go with my German pronunciation. But I am sure that's something that a connection that is made with River, because it's
unfortunately
a book that
was
written in German that has some photographs.
Yes, but I'm very, very sort of taken aback almost by this comparison.
Mm-hmm. Because I always wonder with the photographs there whether they're just photographs he could have picked up from anywhere, and then he decides to sort of thread the narrative with photos.
Yeah, that's really what he did, actually. Yeah. Yes, these are just random objects. You know. Mm-hmm.
I think it's more in terms of the form, in that it's quite unusual to combine images, like photographs, with text.
Well, not really, and I think that would be such a superficial parallel, really. I mean, this is really just a little material similarity. You know, there are photographs, but there is a lot about this particular procedure of taking Polaroid photographs. I really engage with this technique in the book, and the whole book is very much about seeing and naming. And the photography is almost like a a snapshot of what happens in between, you know, what happens between seeing and deciding on the name you give what you have seen. I mean, this is really something that preoccupies me almost, I would say, when I write, yeah? How do I describe what is really the process of description for me and what happens in our heads and anybody's heads, really, you know, between... in this little gap that opens up between seeing something and
what do you think is what can fiction do in describing the world that images or other methods of description, the scientific description of the same scene or a photograph, a painting, where is fiction able to go further in that in describing the world, or what do you think
I can't say generally. I think for me, it is a way of engaging with the world, of finding a language to maybe open up layers which are not directly visible if you always just restrict yourself to the, let's say, consensus about an object and how you call it and how you describe it, yeah? And I would say when I describe something, there is a sentence by the painter Paul Cézanne. I think that's more or less how he said it. He said, before I start painting something, I have to forget everything I know about this object, yeah? And I think this is a kind of approach I like to think I can take as a writer, yeah, that I really find words which are not necessarily based on the consensus of communicating information, yeah.
And with the words that you choose, this is going to be tricky considering that we've read it in translation.
Yeah, it is indeed.
Do you think that if you were writing in German or if you were writing in English, that leads you down very particular paths? Or do you think that you're conceptually, whichever language you prefer, what am I trying to say? Like from the notes you've written, would you always sort of think, okay, you know, this is in German, there's exactly the apt way to put this?
No, I'll tell you something. I always make my notes in English.
All right.
Yeah. I keep a diary in English, have done so for decades, and I make my notes in English, but I only write... I mean, I do write in English occasionally, essays and some poetry and so on, but I wouldn't write a book like this.
Interesting. So was there an initial... I mean, as a child, did you write in English as well? Or was there a point where you decided to start writing notes in English? And
no, there was a point. I mean, I was quite young when English became my sort of everyday language. But I think I have always, as soon as English became a sort of everyday language, I mean, I was a teenager, but that's the point. I think it will always be my language for notes, but for writing, I think I really like to go back to those emotional layers which are also connected with childhood. This is a very interesting process also for me, and to see what I think is everybody has their own language, and it's just very much sort of coerced into these very narrow channels of communication. You know, if we were just left to our own sort of devices, we might find words for things which are very far away from, you know, conventional words. Yeah.
And do you think being multilingual is an easy way? Because do you speak Russian as well?
I speak a few languages.
Yeah, some Hungarian perhaps as well.
Yeah, I do speak Hungarian, yeah.
Yeah, so I wonder if that ever... I mean, that sounds like that's always going to be a good thing, but I wonder if sometimes it makes you do some slight mental acrobatics because you think, there's a really good word in Russian that is completely sums this up. So, okay, how would I then describe that in a... in the most economical way or something in German or English?
Well, I mean, I think, yeah, you're actually right. This does crop up. This I wouldn't call it a problem because I think it is actually... it is very fertile ground because it encourages me to push the boundaries of language, you know, because you so miss a certain level of expressiveness that you see in this one particular word that comes to your mind from another language that you really want to try and find a, or create a solution in the language you're writing in.
Yeah, I think it was very interesting what you're saying about the gap between experience and the naming
or description of the world.
And I can imagine the process between languages as well. There's a moment between the concept and the translation into another language, a similar sort of momentary gap between...
Yes, oh yes, of course. Oh, this gap always remains. It's not momentary. It remains much wider and much more present than between the seeing and the naming, and because they are never... the words between two languages are never, let's say, exchangeable or so.
Now the book is published and you've made the decision to go with one of the words, it will never be 100% match to translate between one or the other.
No, but I mean, this is... I haven't translated my own book. I mean, I sort of release it into the hands of a translator and so I couldn't translate my own book. I think then that would become too difficult.
I guess going back to that gap between the experience and the naming, do you feel once that decision has been made to go with the name or to jump into that particular name, does that then change? How does that change experience, or what effects do you feel that has?
I don't think one can sort of... I wouldn't be able to talk about it analytically, how it changes experience, but I think it's just... I think it's almost... It's always like something that extends the space of language, I would say, for me personally. Yeah.
How does the process of working with the translator work for you as obviously someone who's got experience of translation? I mean, do you work quite closely with the translator?
No, not at all.
You really do release it?
Yeah, I do release it. I mean, there are questions, obviously, and sometimes I'm shocked and I think I wish I had worked a bit more closely, but not in this case. I mean, it was my long-term partner was a translator of German literature, and I had hoped, of course, for him to translate it, but unfortunately he died in 2014. And but then it's an old friend of ours who took it on, so to speak, because Martin did one chapter. And
would you find it difficult to work with the translator? Is it a conscious choice?
I wouldn't want to, because and I think the better you speak a foreign language, the more determined you should be to stay away from meddling in a translation, because being a translator myself, I feel a translator must have the claim to this, must be permitted to be able to lay claim to this text. Yeah, this is his text in a way, you know. It is, I have written about translation, and I like to distinguish between the writer's vision and the translator's version. And I think this version has to exist in its own right. And it is like in Benjamin's essay about translating, it is like one of many echoes which will ultimately contribute to the sort of wholeness of the meaning of the words.
Mm. And going back to the process of moving from notes, that from your description, it sounds as though you're using those notes to kind of try and access the sort of primordial experience of being at that time and place, and then turn that into a novel or a finished piece of work. With the translation, obviously, you don't have access to the author's initial experience, or you know, the driving force. Oh, you have the words on the page, but no memory of being there.
Yeah.
Is that quite different then?
For me, as a translator.
As you're writing River, you're presumably remembering being in these places and putting that experience into the words, whereas if you receive a text to translate, you have no experience beyond the words on the page. And
Yes, but I mean, of course, for a long time I had to translate a lot of stuff to just make a living, but for many years now I have only chosen texts which really interested me for as sort of almost the textual quality of the text interested me. Like I translated John Clare's autobiographical fragments because I found it so interesting what he does with language. I find these fragments, his prose fragments, infinitely more interesting, really, than his poetry, which I like. But I think the prose is a real challenge and very, very interesting. But this also applies to other writers I have translated from other languages. I'm really interested in how can I push the language, you know? This is what interests me.
Do you think, obviously you lived here for quite a long time, and it's something that comes up quite often, that in Britain we have a bit of a problem with translated fiction, and for some reason it seems a sort of harder sell. As someone who's lived in several other places, do you think that is the case?
Yes, I think that is certainly the case. I mean, a lot more is translated now, but I think that the whole idea of what constitutes interesting literature is, when it is translated, is, let's say, as far as it's applied to translated literature, is narrower in Britain, I think, than in other European countries that I have experienced. And one can find so many easy reasons for this, because there is just this gigantic range available from all the Anglophone countries. But still, I do find it very sad sometimes. And coming back to this Sebald issue, I think if there were a little more knowledge also and of the, let's say, hinterland of a foreign writer, people wouldn't jump to such comparisons, you know, because they would sort of realize how different the fabric is, that informs one writer or the other.
Mm-hmm, rather than the sort of superficial connections.
Yeah.
And as someone who writes in several different forms, how do you... Is there a point that your notes would just lend themselves to poetry for you, or is it the greater preoccupations and themes that you're thinking about that lead you to different forms?
Poetry works on a completely different level for me. I mean, for poetry, I don't take notes. Then I really start sort of writing lines of poetry, I would say. I probably also have a more precise notion, or let's say it develops over a much shorter time, what I want to do. I always write sort of coherent cycles of poetry, which are then devoted to a place or to a particular... how shall I say this? A bit... In a way, it's also a place for me, because my last poetry collection was related to Schubert's Winterreise, but for me, this musical piece is so universal and big that it is almost like a place. You know, it may sound weird to you, but it in any case, I have a quicker, shorter term idea of what I want to do, and then I just start writing. And
so they come from kind of different places.
They come from very different places. Right. Yeah. And I usually sort of alternate between prose and poetry, or I've now also started writing radio plays, and because I like to work with sound. And
how would you go about categorizing bad fiction, both in your own writing when you feel stuff is not up to the standard that you want, and in general when you read pieces of fiction? What elements do you feel make a piece of work not so good in terms of the style, the lack of emotional connection, or are there any specific elements that would be kind of top of your list of annoyances with bad writing?
Very, very difficult to say. Maybe what I'm most... I mean, I'm not particularly interested in, let's say, action-based narrative fiction, I think what I really do not like is when you see how a text sort of comes apart at the seams, I would say. Yeah, how if you see a sort of workshop status still shining through, or you can recognize the author's intention, which has not really translated into, let's say, coherent texture, textual fabric. Yeah, this is very difficult to explain this. Yeah, but sometimes you just feel there are such clumsy shortcuts. You know, that's what I really do not like.
Comparison to furniture, being able to see the bad joints.
For instance, yeah. Or bits of glue, you know, where bits of glue come out and have hardened around.
But then possibly your multilingualism make you more sort of discerning about language anyway, and not just in terms of how things are pieced together, but, I mean, you'll be much less taken to falling for cliché and stuff, I would imagine, if you have all the other experiences of other ways of putting things.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm interested in material, and I think that's where I come from.
And do you see a balance between, you talked about the texture of certain texts?
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess there are, I don't know your thoughts on texts that maybe don't have as good texture, and the composition of the text from that point of view is maybe not so revealing, but it describes a powerful experience, or it has an emotional connection. Can you imagine texts that lack the texture but have an emotional connection, or
yeah, but I wouldn't be interested in those texts. I just wouldn't be interested, because for me the way the material is handled is a key to
they have to go together to have an emotional connection.
Exactly,
it has to have the texture.
What are you working on at the moment?
I have just finished this radio play, and one radio play, and I am now working. I'm starting to work on a sequence on Slate poetry. I've discovered these wonderful Slate Islands off the west coast of Scotland, and I'd like to do something around those.
And have you been there?
Yes, I've been there. Yeah, of course. Otherwise, I wouldn't have. I would never decide to write about a place without having been there.
Yeah.
Where is that? Which island?
These are actually small islands just southwest of Oban, the Isle of Seal and Easdale, and.
Yeah, I'm from Scotland, so
I don't know
the
where are you from?
From Inverness, so the east coast. But yeah, I know. I mean, I don't know the specific islands, but.
And thank you very much to Esther Kinski for joining us on a rainy, windy spring / winter evening.
More winter, really. So that was episode 5. Thanks for listening. You can follow us at Unsigned Methods on Twitter or at unsignedmethods.co.uk. You can find me, Lachlan Bloom, at lachlanbloom.com or at Lachlan Bloom on Twitter.
And you can find me at Jamie Batchen on Twitter or jamiebatchen.com. Thank you. Talk to you next time.